Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny. This week, we're looking at how small things illuminate the world with Simon Garfield and his latest book, In Miniature. Simon Garfield is the author of a number of acclaimed books of non-fiction, including A Notable Woman as editor, To the Letter, On the Map, Just My Type, Timekeepers, and Mauve. His study of AIDS in Britain, The End of Innocence, won the Somerset Maugham Prize. And Simon's latest book, In Miniature, How Small Things Illuminate the World, is what we're going to be talking about today. Simon, welcome to Little Atoms.
Very happy to be here, Neil.
So I want to talk about why miniatures. Where did the idea for this book come from?
God, I mean, slightly convoluted, but you will appreciate the wonders of the book that might have been. I had an idea that I think my agent and my editor thought maybe a little bit too obscure, even for me. And if anyone's listening and wants to take this on, be my guest, because I'm not going to do it. The idea was, originally, I was going to have... It was going to be a book called Four Men Build a Railway, and it was going to be about four middle-aged men, my age, putting together a model railway in an attic somewhere. So the idea being that, you know, you have kids and you buy them a train set that you always wanted as a kid, but you never had, and you would actually now have this dream. You'd be much more mature, much more able to afford all the kit that you wanted, and you would get a Hornby set or whatever it was and then build a wonderful landscape around it and learn all about it. And it obviously wasn't really going to be about a model railway. It was actually going to be about the men and their lives and midlife crises and relationships. And but unfortunately, I couldn't find anyone who was willing to do this, because it was going to be quite a forensic thing. It was going to be one day each week for a year, and I was going to interview them, and then it was going to be a wonderful book. I couldn't find anyone who would be my guinea pig for this. And then I thought, actually, it's going to require an amazing feat of skill to try and pull this together into a cohesive book. And then I talked to a couple of people, and they said, you're too obscure. So then I thought, okay, but I am actually interested in miniature things in general. I'm interested in not just model railways and model villages, but the idea of a miniature is something that we sort of neglect, but we use all the time. So be it in artistic ways, if you're a set designer, you would build a model of the you know, stage you're about to build, or if you were an artist, you would obviously often work in maquette form first, or if you were a Victorian entrepreneur, you would be interested in the flea circus, as I was. And so I kind of thought, well, interesting about miniature objects is they tend to make us look far more closely at things that we think we know, and hence the book came about.
But like an architect's model is a vital step on the path to building a building. You know, a scale model of the Taj Mahal made out of matchsticks is a very different ballgame.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it encompasses, I mean, the book encompasses all those, you know, all those kind of ideas. I mean, to take the kind of hobbyist angle, you know, to take the, for instance, in the book, I talked to someone who spent pretty much 70 years of their life building 440 warships out of matchsticks, and any spare time he had, now he's retired, and he would do this, and he says this has created for him not only a history of world warships, and the biggest single collection, you won't be surprised to learn, anywhere in the world. And the museum quality stuff. This is, every model is exacting and beautiful and everything else, and he takes them around to shows. He's done that, but what he's also done is created this hobby where he's created pretty much an ideal world for himself, an ideal hobby. He had a colleague who died who said, well, you will find when you do this that not only does it take up all your time, but the outside world becomes increasingly unattractive. In other words, you create this sort of attic and shed mentality for yourself, and you it's a form, I'd like to see it in a way as a sort of form of mindfulness, in a way, before the term came about. You know, any hobby where you kind of concentrate a lot and you forget your real world problems because you're so concerned with getting the exact minutiae right of whatever you're building. So, and obviously that goes for model villages, and we can talk a bit about, you know, those extreme things which are now sort of still huge, but they've turned into model worlds. So as you say, there's a big gap between that and then the kind of the worker who designs it, you know, as an architect, as you said, or a set designer or an artist. But the same principles apply, I think, which is the value to the viewer is that you understand more by making it, you know, small. So if you were to do a model warship, you will look at the helicopter or the plane or whatever on the deck probably far more closely than you ever would if one just zoomed by. Or if you were on a deck and you would think, this is a huge, you know, fantastic fighter plane, what a wonderful thing. But you wouldn't examine it, I don't think, in the same degree. And the idea of an architect's model, well, it's sort of twofold, I suppose, an architect's model. One is to show your client what you're going to build and they can look around it. It's the only opportunity, of course, where you have of looking down in a sort of godlike way on a model, because, you know, if you're building a new church or even a new house, you can only see it from the front door or the back or the sides when it's fully built in real size. Obviously, this way you can see the whole thing and see how it relates to everything else around it. As an architect building a model, you can also probably conceal certain things as well. You can show certain aspects to be more significant than perhaps they are or they end up. So it's a kind of tool, but it's it serves an immense purpose in a way.
In terms of the book, what counts as a miniature and what's in and what's out?
Mm. I will read a tiny bit that sort of defines my definition of it. So I say, of all the miniature things we'll encounter in the following pages, not all of them will be small. So the impression is, oh, it's got to be tiny. But of course, the miniature railway in Hamburg, which prides itself on being the biggest in the world. It's like 10 miles long, if you include all the track, which is sort of extraordinary. So, not small. The Venetian Hotel in Las Vegas, with its fully workable gondola rides for the romantically obtuse, sleeps 4,000. And obviously the thing about Vegas is there was a trend to create the world in hotel size, you know. So it would be New York and the Venetian and then Paris. And Paris would have, you know, half-size Eiffel Tower and stuff. And then I say, but everything in the book will be miniature in scale compared to the thing it's a miniature of. And then I say, well, things may also perform a miniature duty. So they may explain a concept or solve a puzzle or jog a memory. A souvenir of a building on a key ring, although not very interesting, fits the bill, as does a miniature bottle of gin. A Volkswagen Beetle does not, because it was originally built small, it wasn't smaller than anything else, and nor does an ever-so-small thimble, no matter how keen are those who collect them. Mini bars and lap dogs are borderline, as is the art of bonsai cultivation. A toy poodle made of plastic in a classroom tableau made by five-year-olds is of no interest to anyone.
So, I want to start off with, as you do in the book, with the Eiffel Tower. And, of course, the discussion of the Eiffel Tower gets us on to, you know, the beginning of the idea of the souvenir and, like, the small, obviously, scale versions of the Eiffel Tower. But the Eiffel Tower itself, conversely, does a similar thing to what we're talking about, miniatures, the relationship that miniatures have to their larger objects, in that suddenly, you know, people are able to, you know, the Eiffel Tower goes up. People who have obviously never been in an aeroplane at this time are able to go up the Eiffel Tower and suddenly see Paris, see the world in a completely new way.
Exactly. Why begin the book with the Eiffel Tower, which at the time, when it opened, 1889, was the biggest building in the world and now dwarfed by, you know, 100, of course. But then it was extraordinary. As you say, you needed great courage to go up, you know, even to the first platform. No one had done this before. The tallest building in Paris, or the highest view, was the Notre Dame Cathedral. And then this thing suddenly goes up hundreds of feet, and you go up, and as you say, Neil, that you see miniature Paris laid out in front of you for the first time. No one had ever seen this. So you can see the Haussmann Boulevards. You can see your house maybe in relation to the nearest hospital, how far it is on foot. You've got an idea, but how far it is, you know, when you're looking at it at bird's eye and vertically, it's a very different thing. And you get a sense of two things, I think. You get a sense of enormous omnipotence. You are taller than anything on the ground. You are a giant seeing the whole of your city for the first time. But you also get a feeling of, well, actually, you know, it's a big modernist building and it's the future, and how small we are, really, up in the air in relation to the world around us. And then, as you say, you come down, and for the first time, pretty much, you can buy mass-produced factory souvenirs of the Eiffel Tower. So you can get them as little metal objects to put on your mantelpiece, or you can get the image, you know, in any form of clothing or you know, scarf or handkerchief or that kind of stuff. You could get it as a ring, you know, a silver ring in the Eiffel Tower shape. So that already establishes the idea of ownership and capturing something, and the idea of saying I was there. And then obviously that in time will be joined by other things on the mantelpiece.
And of course, you know, those souvenirs are so ubiquitous in our world now. And obviously, you know, photography, you know, going to visit a place, taking a photograph of it. I think it's difficult to think from a remove that, you know, that tiny little cast iron model of the Eiffel Tower in no way replicates in reality the experience of visiting the thing.
Yeah. And yet it's sort of, the more accurate it is, the more you value it. You know, had it been just a little lump of metal without the sort of an attempt to recreate the filigree element of the metal on the tower itself, i.e. all the crisscrossings and all the triangles and the balconies and the platforms, then it wouldn't have been any good. The key to a miniature that we actually treasure and we're interested in is not something that's just small, but something that's detailed. That's the other point, that the hey wow factor that we have when we're looking at a model village is about the accuracy. It's not the fact that it's small, because anything can be small. You know, I could do the worst model of anything, of my house, out of a bit of cardboard, and no one would say hey wow. They would say that goes in the bin. But if you go to, you know, a model village, what you're amazed at is the detail, the amount of care someone has taken to get everything exactly right.
Well, I wanted to move us on to model villages, basically recreating on the ground that feeling of looking at Paris from the, you know, the top of the Eiffel Tower. And I mean, I visited, you know, like God's Hill and, you know, like various model villages when I was a child. I went, after, you know, reading that chapter, I went online to try and look at how many of these were still in business around the country. And, you know, there's a fair few handful. Yeah. You talk particularly about Beck and Scott.
Yeah.
Again, just look, what's the appeal of these places?
The appeal is infinite and timeless. It's an extraordinary thing. So, I mean, God's Hill is renowned for having a model village within its model village, which is sort of a wonderful kind of concept. Beck and Scott is coming up to its 90th anniversary next year. The dates are a little bit hazy, but that's the one they're claiming. So it opened in 1929, and it began, we think, no one knows exactly, as a model railway inside a house, and the wife of the guy, Reverend Callingham, who built it, got rather frustrated it was taking up a whole house, as these things tend to do, and said, it's either me or the railway. And so the railway went outside to the garden, and then it expanded, and then obviously a model railway itself isn't very interesting. What you need is an interesting landscape. And expanded from there. It's extraordinary. Now it's well, for a while, it's been the size of a football pitch, but it's constantly expanding. So they recently opened a whole new little area, which has, it's all based on the 1930s in a very loose kind of way. So they had a sort of hangar lane type tube that opened there, and they had a town hall that was sort of 1930-ish, but actually more modelled on France. They're very, they don't, you know, I said about the exactitude of it. What they want is the exact dimensions to fit in just about with everything else that's there. What they don't mind so much is it doesn't have to be exactly 1930s, but walking around there, no less entertaining now as an adult as it was for me as a kid. And I took my kids there, and then when I was doing the book, I took some kids of a neighbour, because my kids are grown up now, and their joy, really, because it's such an unusual thing. You know, they have, like everyone else, you know, iPads and everything else. And although they're quite, you know, they do quite a lot of sort of art-related work and craft-related work with their hands as well, these kids. But it's nothing like they've ever seen. But it made me think that actually our interest in miniature stuff really begins as kids. And some of us grow out of it and some of us don't. So, you know, the world is a doomy, confusing place as an adult and as a kid. But as a kid, you have no control over anything really in your life. I mean, your parents pretty much rule the roost, from what your bedroom looks like to when you go to bed to what meals you eat. You know, this is when you're young. School, pretty much the same. So if you're a six-year-old, the idea of having a Lego set or a model train or, you know, not quite as popular as they used to be, an Action Man when I was growing up, or a Barbie doll, which are still obviously huge, those kind of things, you are in control. And it's maybe the only time that you're in control. And so much of the miniature world is about that. It's about setting the world to rights. And you can do that as a kid, and obviously you can do that as an adult. So the idea of a model village at Beaconscott is you're sort of creating an ideal world. That's not to say everything in it is perfect, because even in sort of Beaconscott, in the village, there's a bit of crime going on. There's a kind of old copper chasing a thief with a swag bag sort of across the lawn. There is
terrible puns.
Terrible puns. I mean, so the greengrocer is called Chris P. Lettuce, and the butcher is called, two butchers are called Sam and Ella, and so you've got to say that fast. And anyway, so that goes on, and the adults, yeah, point out the puns to the kids, who were kind of way ahead of the game, obviously. And then there's some general kind of weirdness going on there as well. So, you know, there were arguments. There's arguments in outside areas. You can't hear anyone shouting. You can imagine people shouting. There is graffiti, you know. So it's not the perfect place, but it's a sort of perfect recreation of everything, where there is a fire, but the fire engine is on hand. There is a robber, as I said, but the policeman's there. So, you know, it's still pretty ordered, and there's limited chaos.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
City Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Simon Garfield, and we're talking about his book In Miniature: How Small Things Illuminate the World. And Simon, moving us on from model villages to the already mentioned extension of that, the model railway. Obviously, you talk about model railways in the book, despite the book, the entire book not being about men that run model railways. I think you've already mentioned the Hamburg miniature wonderland, which just sounds like, I mean, the most amazing place.
It's amazing and unnerving, really, as well. So unlike Beck and Scott, which has a, you know, a kind of deep-rooted history, and Beck and Scott is quite an organic place. This isn't an organic place. This is two German guys in Hamburg deciding 10 or so years ago, maybe 15 years ago now, I think, to build the biggest model railway in the world from scratch. So, classic thing, they never really had the railway that they wanted when they were kids. They got some money because they ran a nightclub, these brothers. And they said, they passed a model railway shop in Zurich, I think. One of them was on holiday and called the other one up and said, I've had an idea. And then the idea becomes a reality. And they open up and the model railway just runs through their little model Germany. And then they say, that's not enough. We're going to build. And then they go to model America and their car, model Italy, which is sort of crazy. The model Italy, I think, is the one, is the most sort of impressive and expansive one. So they've got a kind of erupting Vesuvius that erupts every 20 minutes. And you want to warn, as a visitor, you want to warn the people of Pompeii to run for their lives, but they never do, and they get covered, and then they somehow, through a beautiful sort of electronic way, the lava gets swept away underneath them. And they've also got an airport, and they've got cars going, and it's an extraordinary thing to look at. And they're about to build Model Britain, which will inevitably have what the Model Britain always has all over the world, which is Big Ben and the Houses of Parliament and other things as well. So, you know, we're going Brexit, but they're including us in, you know, next to Germany and Italy, and they want us in, which is great. But it's a slightly strange place because you kind of think, well, what is this really about, you know? And what it's about is building something where they're earning quite a lot of money. A lot of people come to it. I say in the book, you know, it's a huge tourist attraction in Hamburg and one of the biggest in Germany. And people just can't believe the intricacy of the whole thing and how beautifully it all runs. And occasionally, because they want to interrupt the beauty of it, they will stage a rail crash or something like that to show that this happens in real life too. And it's in a coffee warehouse on the docks in Hamburg. I found it incredibly impressive on one level. And I also thought, yeah, you can do this if you've got enough great model makers and enough money behind it and enough investment. But what I really like, and I think the real joy I had in the book, was talking to the slightly more eccentric guys, like the guy who built, you know, the 440 matchstick warships. And I love looking at things like the flea circus. And I love talking to the guy who designed those tiny, tiny perforated miniature tabs of acid, each of which had, you know, a little artistic logo or emblem on them. So that's the stuff I really enjoyed. The stuff that was kind of, you know, more obsessive, really, I think.
Well, when I first read the book, I mean, you mentioned, you know, the perhaps surprising fact that people like Rod Stewart and Neil Young are model railway enthusiasts. Since then, I mean, I presume Neil Young has multiple houses, to be fair, but the news that his house in California went with this huge huge fire. And I said to my wife, I wonder if his railway is in that house.
Yeah, I know. I'm sure it was, really. And, I love that. I mean, the fact that kind of Rod Stewart relaxes, that's the way he relaxes, you know, that idea of he goes on tour. If he goes on tour for more than 1 or 2 days, like if he does a week in Las Vegas, Rod takes his railway with him, along with various railway building enthusiasts and assistants, and builds it in his hotel suite. And he finds that, you know, that's the way he can come down after a gig at sort of 11 at night, that by running railway around a track. And there's this wonderful interview that I quote that he did with Piers Morgan, that Piers Morgan goes to Rod's house and says, you know, I hear you've got a railway upstairs. Can I see it? And Rod says no, because he knows that Piers Morgan will just not understand it and take the piss out of it. And it's the last thing he wanted. And also, I was very keen never to do that in the book. You know, I was very keen to... There are clearly some sort of crazy people who devote their whole lives to building very, very, very tiny things. And some of them get really tiny. And I kind of thought, these are, you know, in another world, I might have been one of those kind of guys. And I kind of think, and not all men either, and I kind of think, well, I like the idea of the patience and the dedication. And the last thing I wanted to do was take the piss. But anyway, Rod feared, I'm sure, that Piers Morgan was going to take the piss. And he sort of, even in the interview, he does. In, you know, I should actually, like, quote a little bit where, let me find this bit here where... Rod says to the producer, or maybe the director of this little TV interview they're doing, you know, he turns to them at one stage and says, you know, are people still watching this, like watching me talking about my model railway? And then Piers Morgan says to him, do you like being the driver or the kind of master, which makes it sound like some sort of coded sexual behaviour. And then Rod Stewart says, nah, don't take the piss. I don't wear a little hat. It's a lovely hobby. It's like reading a book or painting a picture. It's three-dimensional. It's wonderful. And I say, you know, and if you don't get that, then the sort of the loser is you, in a way. There's a famous film, originally a French film, which is called Les Dîners du Con, which was Hollywoodized into Dîner for Schmucks, which I'm sure you know, where Steve Carell is invited classically to this dinner where these very elitist hedge funders or wealthy guys who think they're the bee's knees think, wouldn't it be brilliant to invite a guy who's a bit of an idiot for dinner so we can take the piss out of him? And both in the French version and in the American version, the guy they invite is a modeler, and he builds the Eiffel Tower out of matchsticks. And I say, you know, this guy, it's like sort of Shakespearean fool who knows more than his masters in a way, really. This is the guy who comes out on top. And I say, you know, he, the modeler, is happier in his world than the people who invite them are in theirs.
Well, just to finish off then, Simon, you have mentioned that a lot of the people that do this are men, and I imagine people that are listening probably would suspect that too. So let's finish off talking about a woman modeller. And in fact, there's a whole section of the book about domestic modelling. Queen Mary's incredible, you know, a huge working dollhouse that you can see at Windsor Castle, and the Thorn miniatures at the Chicago Art Institute. But I want to talk about Frances Glessner Lee. Her nutshell studies.
Yeah.
What are they?
An amazing person. So in the 1920s and 1930s, Frances Glessner Lee lived in Chicago. She was a traditional builder of little model houses and little model tableaus, and would build tiny little chests of drawers to go in houses. And this was, you know, a fun thing, and still popular now. And miniature, you know, modelling, as we said, not only, absolutely not an exclusive kind of male thing. And she became friendly with someone in the local police force who was quite high up. And he was aware that when his detectives went to see a crime scene for the first time, they didn't really look carefully enough at it. And what they did was they looked at the body. They may have moved evidence, which now classically we know we never do. And they kind of thought, OK, we can solve this, or, you know, this is going to be easy. What they found was that actually what you really needed is at the spot, as soon as you get called in, the clues are often all there, you know. You don't have to do all the interviews. But what you need to do is look more closely. So what he encouraged Francis Glessner Lee to do was to build these tableaus, which I suppose were the size of a shoebox or a very small TV set or something like that, which depicted a corpse always, and then various other elements in it. Now, these would be based either on a true life crime or an imaginary crime, and often a combination of the two. And the idea was to encourage people to look at the whole scene. You begin with often the body in the middle. The body might be hanging from a rope in a barn, or it might be in a bathtub, and then water would still be dripping like silver foil from the tap, and everything in there would be incredibly exact. So there would be a medicine bottle that was a tiny, tiny version of a real-life medicine bottle. So it was instantly recognisable as a real place. You believed it. And the idea was that you would just look and there would be enough clues there, not necessarily to solve the crime, but to understand the circumstance far more. Extraordinary thing is, these things are still used as ways of examining and ways of educating and coaching new detectives in looking at things. So, you know, 70, 80 years on, these are still incredibly valuable things. And I say in the book, you know, the closer you look, the more you see, the closer you look. So it's this kind of wonderful spiral. But can I just say, Neil, the you know, we've talked a lot, obviously, about models, and this does actually have a use in real life. And I was very keen when I talked to, you know, architects, and when I looked at theatre set designers, to look at, you know, real world use, I suppose. And the most important tale that I came across, and I had a lot of fun doing the book, but the most important one was a very serious one, which was about, well, late 18th century, the slave trade was roaring, really. Britain was getting wealthy on the back of sugar and cotton plantations, and the triangular slave trade meant that slaves would come in from Africa, they would land in Liverpool, and they would be shipped out to, let's say, Jamaica. And people were getting very, very wealthy on this trade. We were obviously treating people in a terrible way, and slaves were shackled in these kind of coffin ships, they were called, and they were crammed in, you know, 300 or 400 to a boat below decks. And they would often die on the voyage, or, you know, arrive totally emaciated. And they were obviously, you know, utterly subservient to their masters and whipped on these things. They only knew about this, thought this was a terrible thing and the slave trade must end. So people like William Wilberforce in Parliament would get up and make speeches. Had very little effect for a long time because there was so much money at stake. What happened was a banker and a royal academician called William Alford went up to Liverpool, drew a poster of what he imagined, because he went to a ship, didn't see the slaves, that the slave galleys and the slave ships to actually look like, did a poster, all these black men, typically shackled together in terrible conditions. This had some impact. The poster was duplicated, printed in early newspapers. But only when this was made into a miniature model, someone made, unknown person, made a wooden model and cut out the drawings of these slaves and put them throughout the boat, crammed them in. And when this went round Parliament in people's hands, only then could they really understand what conditions were like. Now, this didn't end the slave trade overnight, but it gave people a visual insight that they'd never had before. And the reason I liked that was because it showed the value of a model like nothing else.
I've been talking to Simon Garfield. We've been talking about his book, In Miniature, How Small Things Illuminate the World, which is out now from Canongate. Simon, thank you so much for coming in and telling me about it.
I really loved coming in, Neil.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny, and was first broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. Little Atoms is supported by 89UP, and the podcast is hosted by Acast. Find us on iTunes, and if you like the show, please do leave us a review. You can find old interviews, new journalism and more on our website, littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.